Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, to promote tolerance, and to foster peace. As an independent learning center, we do not represent any particular religion or faith. The Godspeed Institute presents views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, and we try to help people gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world and to help people find tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Michael Hollenbach. Today on the Godspeed Institute, we're delighted to welcome one of the great scholars and teachers of Judaism and of prayer of our time, Rabbi and Professor Reuven Kimmelman. Rabbi Kimmelman is a professor of classical Judaica at Brandeis University. Previously, he was the Joseph Scheer Distinguished Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Toronto and Five College Professor of Judaic Studies at Amherst College. He has also taught at Mount Holyoke, Smith, Trinity, and Williams Colleges, as well as the Jewish Seminary of America, Yeshiva University, and the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel. Professor Kimmelman holds a PhD from Yale University in Religious Studies, and he has been published widely in journals and scholarly and popular interest in the Bible, ethics, liturgy, and current affairs. He's the author of the Hebrew work, The Mystical Meaning of Lecha Dodi and Kabbalat Shabbat, published by the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His audio course books includes The What, How, and Why of Biblical Ethics, and one on the hidden poetry of the Jewish prayer book called The What, How, and Why of Jewish Liturgy. Currently, among other things, he's working on a book on the meaning and history of Jewish prayer, and another one on terrorism, war, democracy, and the Jewish ethics of power. Welcome to the show today, Rabbi Kimmelman, and thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Michael.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time and coming on to share your significant knowledge, your experience, and your understanding of Judaism and Jewish life. This is a very big topic, and we will only scratch the surface today in this program. I'm hoping for the benefit of our listeners around the world, that you could maybe start by taking us on a brief journey into the history of Judaism. And what I'm thinking of is, for example, where is the beginning? Where in the world did this faith originate? Around what time in history are we talking, and that sort of things? And please feel free to take your time. We are not a debating forum on Godspeed. We represent no particular faith or belief, but rather we're a space for people to learn about and better understand the world's religions and spiritual belief systems and all their expressions. So maybe you could begin in the beginning. Is that possible?
Well, the story of Judaism, strangely enough, begins about 3,500 years ago in Iraq. The history of Judaism starts with the call to Abraham to leave Iraq and go to the land that God will show him. So if anybody could claim to be the first Jew, it was Abraham. Now Abraham, it's almost ironic that he is the only person in the Bible who's called the father of many nations, and it turns out that in the 21st century, over half of humanity refer back to Abraham as either their physical or spiritual father. And this is so significant that if you include Islam, Christianity and Judaism, they've sometimes been described as the Abrahamic faiths. So the first Jew is Abraham. He's called the father of many nations. And in the 21st century, that has reached a fulfillment probably unprecedented. I don't think there's any person in the world except for God who is called father by more people than Abraham. Now, Muslims relate to him through Ishmael, but it's not biological. Christians relate to Abraham as a model of faith, and Jews relate to him as their own father and as a model of faith. So the origins of Judaism turns out to be also, in some sense, the origins of Christianity and Islam. Hmm. And then, of course, he was called by God to go to the land of Israel, which probably explains why all three religions have an amazing fascination with everything which takes place in the land of Israel, because in the image of all three, the land of Israel is the land of Abraham. And therefore, the significant events in Abraham's life resonates throughout all Abrahamic faiths. Hmm. And there, Abraham, it says he was chosen because he had the capacity to teach his children to keep the way of the Lord. And the way of the Lord is defined there as justice and fairness. It's quite remarkable. So justice, because of Abraham's commitment to justice and fairness, and his ability to get it over to his children, that explains more than any other explanation why Abraham was chosen out and not somebody else. And it's probably through the commitment of justice and fairness that Israel, the children of Abraham, can become a blessing to all the nations.
Mm. Thank you very much for that answer. Is it possible for you to briefly describe how the Muslim faith and the Christian faith traces back to the Abrahamic faith? I know you said it, but exactly where, how do they trace back? I mean, where are the connections? Are there any? How do they all? Maybe we could talk about the connections, but how do they split?
Well, the split.
You mentioned Ishmael, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was Ishmael?
The split is based upon two models.
Yes.
One is a genealogical model, and one is a faith model. So historically speaking, Christianity rose, and Paul claimed to have the faith of Abraham. And therefore, having the faith of Abraham, even though Paul also was Jewish, and therefore he could claim the biological descent.
Sure.
Christians, of course, are not biologically or ethnically a group, and therefore cannot be connected to Abraham biologically. But he claimed that he modeled the faith of Abraham. And it's based upon ideas like this that some Christians actually claim they were the true Israel, that they had the real faith of Abraham.
Oh, okay.
Muslims go through Ishmael. Ishmael is the first son of Abraham through his wife Hagar. But Islam arises about the year 622 after the conflict of Medina and then the return to Mecca by Muhammad. So it is also apparently probably based upon a model, kind of a biological faith model. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that because you have about 1,500 years to 2,000 years of a gap. It's very difficult to trace a biological line.
Yes.
With a 2,000-year gap. But insofar as Islam claims, which the word Islam means total subordination to God, and that Abraham was also totally subordinate to God, they could claim that they're following the model of Abraham and their commitment to their faith.
Mm-hmm.
So however the argument is made, what is quite impressive is that all three religions trace to one individual the model of their faith, and this individual, Abraham, precedes the major person in their faith. That is, Abraham precedes Moses, which creates another covenant with Israel.
Yes.
Abram, of course, precedes Jesus, and Abram, of course, precedes Muhammad. So these three individuals, who are one could call the founders of the respective religions, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, from the point of view of the distinctiveness of the religion, they go back to these three people. Insofar as they claim some degree of commonality, they go back to Abraham. So you could say, one could say anyhow, that Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad is what divides the three, in some sense, while Abraham is that which unites the three.
Huh. Thank you very much for that explanation. Now, I'm trying to understand, from your perspective, are there any glaring misconceptions that you see around Judaism in mainstream today?
I think Judaism is probably the worst known world religion. primarily because it is small. The numbers come nowhere near of Christianity and Islam, which are the two major expansionist religions in the world. And I think the reason is because of a confusion between universalism and imperialism, meaning Christianity and Islam have mounted probably the two largest missionary efforts in the history of humanity, and together have captured a significant portion of humanity. And therefore, they convert their universalism and their imperialism. By imperialism, I mean the desire to make everybody else like you converge. Judaism is as universal as they are, but not as imperialistic. Therefore, there's not the drive of Judaism to convert the world to Judaism, but there is a drive to convert the world to God. And that's an interesting distinction. Yeah. Because in Christianity and Islam, in its classical expressions, conversion to their religion and conversion to God are really the same thing. In Judaism, people can be brought close to God without becoming Jewish. So the universalism we hold in common, the imperialism we do not hold in common, and that may explain a major difference.
Yes, it certainly would. Now, you mentioned Judaism being a small religion. Are there any kind of numbers behind that? Approximate how many Jewish people live on the planet today?
Well, it's hard to know exactly because part of it is an issue of definition.
Yeah.
And part of it is an issue that many people call themselves by multiple adjectives.
Okay.
But normally people estimate close to 15 million. Of which at least three-quarters of those are found now in Israel and the USA, each one having about 5 to 6 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two major areas are Russia and France, which adds up to a million. And then another 2 million are so scattered around the world. And remarkably is, this is really quite recent, meaning probably 95% of the Jews in Israel and America did not live there 150 years ago, which means that Jews have been moving around the world, primarily fleeing persecution, and very few Jews live now in any single place for longer than 150 years, and most of them less than half of that. So there's a almost a universal dispersion. But there are two great concentrations.
Yeah. Now, it is a fairly small religion and small group of people, but it's my understanding that there are many different kinds of, maybe, pardon me if I'm using the wrong terms, but there are many different types of Jewish people, or there's Orthodox Jewish, there are Hasidic Jewish, there are Reformed Jewish. Could you talk a little bit to that?
Well, most of the divergences which you mentioned, which are popularly known as Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, there's also a phrase called Reconstructionist, Humanistic, Renewal, Hasidic, all these are quite recent phenomena, and they are significantly a theological and sociological response to the emancipation of the Jew. When I say the emancipation, up to, let's say, 1800, over 95% of world Jewry lived under Christian and Muslim domination. As such, they survived under their domination for over 1,000 years as second-class citizens, frequently persecuted.
Hmm.
So they were defined by the dominant political group or dominant religious group. As the 1800s and 1900s rolled in, more and more Jews were liberated from this, and therefore they disagreed on how to respond to the conditions of civic freedom. And much of the differences are based upon differences in theology and differences of degree of integration into modern culture when modern democratic cultures allowed the Jews to freely practice. So that explains some of the major differences between these different groups. But they are probably unified more than they are divided, meaning almost every religious group has major divisions, but we have rarely have had in Judaism anything like the mass killing which took place between the Protestants and the Catholics in a single period of 30 years,
yeah.
or the kind of internecine bombing which is going on every day in the Muslim world almost every single day. I've seen different groups. That is rare. So it could be due to our size, it could be due that we have more commonality than diversity, or it could be we're too small to risk the chance of killing each other off like other groups have, is interesting.
Mm.
But the diversity is great, and despite that diversity, it's amazing how much unity there is, despite the diversity of belief and theology and geographical location.
Mm.
Probably by virtue of the fact that almost all Jews have a sense of common origins. So, for example, on the holiday of Passover, they all celebrate the Exodus from Egypt. So this idea of having a common origin, sometimes having a common fate, and sometimes having a common destiny, are probably the three great unifiers of world Jewry.
So would you, I'm curious, would you say that in the Jewish world, between the different the different viewpoints, that there is a common sense of understanding? Do you see people get together from different directions?
Oh, what's remarkable in Judaism is, for example, to create a quorum for prayer. The requirement is 10 Jews. They don't have to be 10 Orthodox Jews or 10 Reformed Jews, just 10 Jews.
Hmm.
So, for example, there's a special prayer said when a person passes away called the Kaddish. That prayer needs 10 people present, six of which are actively praying. And they could be of any Jew whatsoever, because universally all Jews accept the idea that a person who came out of a Jewish womb is Jewish. Now, other groups give even additional definitions. But everybody agrees that either conversion or born to a Jewish mother makes you a Jew, and that rock-bottom definition is a great unifier.
Mm. Now, thank you so much for explaining that. I'm wondering, could you address a question in my mind, like, what is the center of, is there a center of Jewish life? Is there like a center of life that's important to Jews?
Well, it depends what you're talking theologically, sociologically, or politically.
Theologically.
Well, theologically, the center, of course, is God and the Torah. The idea that there is a single God, and that this single God has a special relationship to the people of Israel, and that his expression of love for them is evidenced by the fact that God gave them a Torah, is probably the central belief in Judaism.
Hmm.
I don't know if any of the belief would be more central, holds more together.
Hmm.
So this idea that the election of Israel has two elements. One is it's a result of divine love, and the divine love is concretized through a book of instruction. See, the idea is that if you love somebody, you try to help them to live the best life possible. therefore you give them instruction. So teaching and loving goes together, and thus God is frequently perceived as a teaching God. Mm-hmm. Remarkable. Most people talk about God as king, God as sovereign, which we also do, God as merciful, which we also do. We emphasize God as loving, and loving as expressed through teaching, and teaching as expressed through the teaching, the Torah, which is a book on the enhancement of life.
Now, I have, there's a quick question that's roaming around my mind. I was not born of a Jewish mother,
mm-hmm.
so I did not come out of a Jewish womb. Is there a conversion process to Judaism?
Oh, yes, there is a conversion process, and there may be more converts to Judaism in this century than any time in human history. The only time which would percentage was comparable was probably in the first century. It seems in the first century there were a large number of Jewish converts, but by the fourth century, by 315, 325, when the Christians took over the Roman Empire, where most Jews lived, they prohibited it. It became a capital crime. And then when the Muslims took over North Africa and most of the Middle East, it became a capital crime there. So over, I would say, 1,200 years, the desire to convert or the movement to convert was sufficiently subdued.
Hmm.
But the 21st century is really the first time in memory that Jews are competing on the open, let's say, open religious intellectual market. So you have people who leave Judaism and people coming in. But now they estimate over tens of thousands of converts on a regular level, and in the state of Israel, it far exceeds their capacity to process the people.
Mm.
So just to tell you, so for example, if you lived in, let's take a city, Cincinnati, or just any city in America,
yes.
in the 1950s, and two Jews were talking, and they said, "There goes a convert," the other person would assume the person was born Jewish, but had converted to Christianity.
Oh, okay.
But if you said it nowadays, but to the 21st century, mm-hmm. and two Jews were talking, and one said to the other, "There goes a convert," mm-hmm. they would both assume the convert meant what? A person who had been of another religion and converted to Judaism.
Uh-huh.
So there has been a revival worldwide, but primarily in Israel and America, mm-hmm. of people who either want to return to Judaism who left the generations earlier, or whose curiosity is piqued, either by their beliefs, by their practice, or something going on in Israel, which has quickened that faith and brought them back to the one God.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something very briefly before. I just wanted to go back to that. I was not aware of. You said that most in the 3rd and 4th century after Christ, there was most Jews lived in Rome?
The Roman Empire.
Okay.
Don't be Israel was part of the Roman Empire.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So was Egypt part of the Roman Empire.
Oh, sure.
There were major communities in Rome.
Oh, sure.
In Greece, Israel, Egypt had a major community.
Oh, sure.
So on, yes.
Yes, sure. Now, could you briefly also touch on, I know that there is a strong connection to East Africa, Ethiopia. Who are the Ethiopian Jews? And how
there are several Jewish groups,
yes,
which really lost their connection with world Jewry probably over 2,000 years ago. It's unclear. There are groups in India apparently like that, mm. and groups in Africa and Ethiopia, and they was a very difficult time to determine their Jewishness. But anyhow, in the last 40 to 50 years, almost everybody agrees they are Jews
mm-hmm.
who left Israel sometime, maybe 2,500 years ago. Some people trace it back to the time of the destruction of the Second Temple in the time of the prophet Jeremiah.
Mm.
Some people think it was earlier. Anyhow, these people have retained their Jewishness in Ethiopia, even though there was a large move to try to coerce them into conversion to Christianity.
Sure.
And in the last 30, 40 years, about 30,000, maybe more, have come to live in Israel.
Mm.
And become part of the Jewish community of Israel.
Is this part of the 1,500
year period you were describing before that's a little hard to track down?
This is a period of time which the Ethiopian Jewish culture was primarily oral,
not written down, yes.
And therefore it's hard to trace it.
Yes.
But it's clear by their practices that they their practices and their own sense of memory and the specific Jewish things they do, that they are more Jewish than anybody would imagine as Christian.
Uh-huh.
And their claim to be so, and the phrases they use, and their knowledge of Hebrew. So it's apparently these Jews in Ethiopia who lost contact are now reestablished, just like there was a large Jewish community in China for hundreds of years. Most of it was wiped out when the communists came, starting in 1949, although now I just heard from somebody a couple of days ago of a person who went back to Kaifeng, and he's talked to grandchildren of these people who were Jewish, and apparently even among them, there's a revitalized interest in finding about Judaism, and maybe even return, because China is now more open to this possibility than it was 40, 50 years ago.
Huh. That is interesting.
Even in Spain and Portugal, we find groups of people who were supposedly converted 400 years ago,
yes,
but maintained their Jewishness. And now that both Spain and Portugal allow for the freedom of religion, you have groups reasserting themselves who want to return back to the people of Israel.
Huh.
So all this is quite remarkable.
Yes, it certainly is. Thank you so much for explaining all this. So we're just to recap a little bit, maybe we're going back to Abraham, who received a call from God in Iraq. Is that correct?
Yes.
And from there, the Jewish people has been spreading out, basically an attempt to return to Israel for 3,500 years. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, Abraham is the first person to go from outside of Israel to come to the land of Israel.
Yes.
But don't forget his grandson, Jacob, already took his children down to Egypt because of the famine in the land.
Yes.
Where they were enslaved in Egypt, and then when they left at the Exodus, to come back into the land. But in the first 1,000 years, Israel was conquered by not only the Egyptians, but also the Assyrians. Well, first the Philistines, then the Assyrians, then the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans, then the Byzantines, then Islam, then Persia, then the Ottoman Empire, then the British. And each one of this has caused different problems for Jews living in the land of Israel.
The free
ability to go back to the land of Israel really started significantly in 1948.
Yeah, there sure has been a lot of conflict in that region. We are going to, we're getting right up to the half-mark point of our show today, where we're going to take a short break. You're listening to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network, and we are talking with Rabbi Reuven Kimmelman, who is professor of classical Judaica at Brandeis University. We're going to take a short break with a piece of music here, but please stay with us. After the break, we will continue our exploration into Judaism with Rabbi Kimmelman. Here's a song by Keru, and it is called Eden.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Hallenbeck, and we're talking about Judaism with Rabbi and Professor Reuven Kimmelman. Professor Kimmelman, I would like to, first of all, thank you very much for your description of the historical Judaism. I know there's a lot more to it, and it takes a lot more than an hour. But I'd like to try and switch gears a little bit now and talk about how Jewish people practice their faith, including, you mentioned before that the that God's instructions to the Jewish people are written down in what is known as the Torah. Could you explain the Torah to our audience?
Well, the word Torah really is a shortened form for the word Tanakh. Tanakh refers to the tripartite Bible. The word T stands for the word Torah, which means the five books of Moses. The Tanakh Nun stands for Nevi'im, which are the prophets, including Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah, Hosea, and so on. And then the rest of it is called the writings, which includes the book of Job, Proverbs, Psalms, and the different scrolls. That is the Jewish Bible, the majority of which was written in Hebrew. In addition to the what was called the written law, classical Judaism believes in an oral law called which was written down in the Mishnah and the Talmud, which primary function is the interpretation and the application of the Torah to life. So those are your two classical central books, Torah, Tanakh, Bible. And I should say the word Hebrew Bible, meaning the Bible primarily written in Hebrew, as opposed to the Greek Bible, which is primarily the Christian edition to the Bible, which was almost all written in Greek. So they're divided both by languages and by religions. So the first part, which the Christians used to call, although call it less and less, the Old Testament, they call it less that because the word old really means antiquated, partially rejected, and as Christianity has renewed its understanding and appreciation of historical Judaism, they frequently use the phrase First and Second Testament as opposed to old and new. The Jews just use the phrase Tanakh or Hebrew Bible.
So is it correct? Is it a correct understanding that what a Christian would call the Old Testament in basic is the basic instructional text for Jewish life?
Yes, it's very similar. Except what people do not realize is that the what is called the Old Testament, while almost all the books are in common, they are not structured the same way. Meaning, if you look at the first five books of Moses, that begins both of them. When it comes to the prophets and the writings, they disagree on how to structure it. So, for example, Christianity will end with the prophet Malachi, because at the end of the prophet Malachi, he announces the coming of Elijah. And then Christians add what they call the New Testament, which begins with the Gospel of Matthew, which begins with the birth of Jesus, and therefore the message is that Jesus is that which Elijah prophesies. But in Judaism, the end of the Bible ends with the book of Chronicles. In the book of Chronicles, the last line is the Persian king allowing the Jews to return back to the land of Israel and rebuild the temple. So both Christians and Judaism read their Bible and they finish it with a redemptive twist. The difference is there are different conceptions of redemption. But the actual writings of the book are about 99% in common, except the added Christian parts or the added parts of individual books. So we hold the Bible in common, and frequently it's our common Bible which divides us, because we sometimes read the same book but read it through different lens.
Yes. Thank you so much for that answer. Now, let's talk a little bit about the daily life, the daily Jewish life. And religious Jewish life. What does that entail?
Well, one of the foundation aspects of Jewish religious life is the saying of 100 blessings daily. the rabbis told us that we're not allowed to receive pleasure in this world without uttering a blessing. And in fact, if one has pleasure from this world or benefit without a blessing, he commits an act of sacrilege. By sacrilege means he misappropriates an object which had been dedicated to the temple. So by saying 100 blessings a day, it corresponds to the 100 sockets, which the Bible claims was in the structure of the ancient temple or tabernacle. And thus, in saying 100 blessings a day, we reconstruct the temple as part of the spiritual universe. And thus, every blessing begins with the same six-word Hebrew formula, which in English comes out, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, sovereign of the world." And there are three expressions because there are three aspects to it. "Blessed are you" is the self talking to God. Then we say, "The Lord our God," which is now the community relating to God. And it ends with "sovereign of the world," which is humanity relating to God. So the function of saying these blessings is to create three circles of self-reference. That is, I belong to a community. I relate to God. I belong to a community that relates to God. And I hope to belong to a humanity that will all one day relate to God. So these 100 blessings constitute the basic prayer life of the Jew. And then the most significant affirmation is actually the Shema, which also is composed of six words, just like the blessing, and structured the same way. And it says, "Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And therefore is the primary Jewish statement to proclaim the singularity and unity of God. And these blessings or types of prayers are generally organized three times a day. There are three official prayer times, frequently close to dawn, from midday through the afternoon, and in the evening, corresponding to the three transformations of nature, because part of prayer is to sensitize us to the beauties and transformations of nature. So, for example, let's say you're walking by the way, and you suddenly hear a thunderstorm. So when you hear the thunder, you have to say a blessing. Or you walk by the way, and you see a new tree blossoming. You have to stop and say a blessing. You're walking by the way, and you see a beautiful scene of nature, let's say the Niagara Falls. You stop, you say a blessing. You pick a flower, and it smells good. You stop, you say a blessing. In other words, all of life is kind of punctuated with these blessings. The function is which to sensitize us that we live in a God-created universe.
Mm. It's sounds like the same thing that some people would refer to as being mindful of the world.
Yes, it's very close to this idea of mindfulness,
yes.
But it's not mindfulness in general, but mindfulness in specific.
Yes, and gratitude.
Yes, the gratitude. I would assume that the basic religious posture worldwide is an overwhelming sense of gratitude.
Yes. So could you explain the role of family life in Jewish life?
Well, family life, interesting enough, at a marriage, there are seven blessings. And many of these blessings recall the life of Adam and Eve, very strangely enough.
Mm.
In other words, the coming together of a husband and wife is perceived as replaying the coming together of Adam and Eve. Now, the reason this is interesting is because according to the Bible, or at least according to the Jewish understanding of the Bible, the original entity called Adam was really not male. That entity was male and female. This
I'm
is
sorry,
before the
you,
splitting
sorry,
of the
could
Adam.
You, could you say that again?
The original entity, which we call Adam,
yes.
People generally associate Adam as being male. While the Bible, chapter 1, verse 28, refers to this entity, Adam, as male and female. In other words, the original entity was double sexuality to it, and therefore could have reproduced like an amoeba or by cloning.
Hmm.
And the Bible says the reason you have two genders is because the individual is so overwhelmingly lonely. That is, the human existential situation is loneliness. And this is overcome by having a counterpart. So by virtue of that, the original Adam was split into two, and that which emerged became female, and that which was left became male. So the chapter 2 of Genesis ends and says, therefore a man will leave his husband, his father and mother, and join his wife and become one flesh. So that sexuality is understood as restoring the original unity. And to make this point, the blessings which are said at a wedding talk about Adam and Eve. In other words, every marriage is like a restoration of the original entity. And through marriage, the human being becomes whole. So the unmarried man is called a palga, which means a half a man. How does a man become a full human being? By getting his other half. Who is the other half? The female. So these halves together created a whole, and therefore relive, as it were, the original Adam. And since the original Adam was called the image of God, there's an interpretation that humanity achieves the image of God through the interaction of the male and the female. Because I as a male am not a whole human being, nor is a female a whole human being, but together we emerge into wholeness, and that's why together we can reproduce. That's the original idea of Jewish marriage.
There was a
That's why children are always considered a blessing in Jewish marriage.
There was one of my personally favorite quotes was from a popular scientist, an American popular scientist called Carl Sagan. He said, for small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. And it reminds
And me. Therefore, it, love can be cultivated through interrelationships.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not that I have love and love, it's that through loving, loving gets expanded.
Yes. How does that relate, I'm curious, in Jewish terms, how does that relate to the word would be romantic relationship or familiar relationships, love between men and women, perhaps on a professional level? Does that exist in any way?
Between men and women?
Yes.
Well, I would say in generally classical Judaism, like all classical Abrahamic faiths, are very careful on male-female relationships if one of them is already married.
Yes, of course.
Because, interesting enough, in Judaism, the image of monogamy and the image of monotheism is constantly used by the prophets.
Yeah.
So apparently the loyalty cultivated by marriage is similar to the loyalty cultivated by religion. And that allegiance to the one God or the allegiance to the one spouse, the prophets frequently use as analogies of each other, which is why when ancient Israel sometimes abandoned their one God, the expression they used was whoring after other gods. So that the sexual image and the theological image reinforced each other. So, and just like the original couple was only one man and one woman, so I would say friendship is one thing, but love, which frequently demands the giving of one's all, even one's body, is reserved for marriage love.
Yes.
On the other hand, love between human beings, I mean the phrase, love your neighbor as yourself, is found in the third book of the Torah, Leviticus.
Yes. Could you explain to me the, I know these are big topics, but could you touch of the concept of Jewish concepts of sin?
Sin is operates in two levels. Sin primarily is an act of separation. So that which separates humanity from God or separates humanity from each other becomes sinful. So, for example, probably one of the best known Jewish holy days is Yom Kippur, which is translated in English as a day of atonement, which really means a day of at-one-ment. And beforehand, one is trying to cleanse oneself and repair the relationship between our fellow human being and God. So by repairing the relationship, now repairing means to bring people closer together, while sin is that which divides them. Okay, so sin is the great divider, while atonement becomes the great unifier. So on a day of atonement, when I stand in prayer and ask God to forgive me, before I do that, I have to go up to those human beings whom I've offended and wronged and seek their forgiveness first. For God cannot forgive me for a wrong that I've done to my fellow human being without me first seeking reconciliation.
Mm.
So sin divides us, and the opposite of sin in Judaism is called a mitzvah. And the mitzvah is what unites us. So those acts which bring humanity closer to God are mitzvah-focused.
Mm.
And those acts which bring people away from God or fellow human being are sin-focused.
Mm. Oh, that's very interesting. Let's touch a little bit about on prayer, on the concept of prayer in Jewish life. It's my understanding that Judaism is a very prayerful religion. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the prayers are part of the Torah or the different books?
Oh, the prayers are in a prayer book.
Yes.
Which a significant part of it comes from the book of Psalms.
Okay.
In fact, the book of Psalms is one of the great unifiers between Jews and Christians. That is, the greatest source of inspiration for their own prayers comes from the book of Psalms.
Okay.
But in addition to the book of Psalms, there are also other central prayers in Judaism. The two most significant is called the Shema, which I said was a declaration of the unity of God and the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
Another prayer is called the 18 Benedictions, which is the center of almost every statutory Jewish prayer, which there are three. I said closer to dawn, in midday to throughout the day, and in the evening, reflecting the three transformations of the natural cycle.
Mm.
But that's what I call public prayer.
Sure.
There's also private prayer. And the prayer book tells you your public prayers. So those public prayers are said as a member of the community. There are also people praying all the time on private issues. One of the functions of public prayer is to bring a person out of the concerns only with the self and include the concerns of others, which is why almost all public prayer is expressed in the plural. While private prayer has a tendency to be expressed in the individual. And so they balance each other. So I would say private prayer is significantly self-centered, and public prayer is more God-centered, and we need both.
Mm. Yes. So is Judaism and Jewish life centered around temples or churches?
Yes, but we call them synagogues.
Okay.
Although some groups call them temples. So the word synagogue, S-Y-N, just means where people congregate together. And there's two major places. It's called a synagogue and the academy. And they reflect the two major religious activities, which is prayer and study. It is rare in Judaism that prayer is not done without some study. So that prayer, it's like the balance between the emotional and the intellectual life, and they must be integrated.
Yes.
So even if you go to a formal prayer service, there are elements of study.
Yes.
Just like the study of Torah will frequently end with a prayer. And it's popularly conceived of prayer is human-initiated and God-directed, while the study of Torah was human-directed and God-initiated.
Hmm.
So one studies God's Torah to discern what one should do in this world to improve it, to make it a better world.
Mm.
And then the third major activity is the actually doing of good deeds. So you could say that the three foci, one is inward, the other one is upward, and the other one is outward.
Mm. That's very holistic. Are there any holy sites in Judaism, and what are the holiest sites for Jewish people?
Well, that's a great question, because holiness in Judaism comes in two forms.
Okay.
Space and time. I don't think most people realize this, but the first thing called holy in the Torah is the Sabbath. So the sanctity of time historically precedes the sanctity of space.
So the holiness of Sabbath. Can you explain Sabbath briefly to
us? Sabbath is in the book of Genesis.
Yes.
The final day of creation, coming every seventh day, and it's the only day which is distinguished by God blessing it and making it holy. And one of the ways of making it holy was desisting from regular work. And therefore a day of, like an armistice, in the workaday week. So while 6 days of the week, one fulfills the divine mandate of transforming the world to make it reflect the kingdom of God, you have a seventh day, which is a day of appreciation. One does not interfere in the natural world. One doesn't do any work. One worships. So in a sense, the 6 days, I call the shots. And the seventh day, I realize that God calls the shots. And therefore, I'm a servant of God, not just a servant of my own vision. And that is called the Sabbath, which we call holiness in time. And holiness in space, probably the most holy space in Judaism, is Jerusalem, where the ancient temple was. There are other cities which have kind of a quasi-holy status. But the only one which really has a holy status is Jerusalem, and that's because that's where the ancient temple was, and that's where God was centrally worshipped. So you could argue that holiness, the more God is sensed, the greater the holiness. So during the week, God is most sensed on the Sabbath, therefore becomes holy. Jerusalem is, is where God is most sensed spatially, therefore becomes holy. It's a strange idea, but even though people believe that God is everywhere, apparently psychologically, it's important to feel that God is somewhere in order for a person to believe that God is accessible everywhere.
Yes.
So I would argue that in Judaism, holiness works on four planes. That is space, time, the human, and divine. Space primarily focused in Jerusalem. Time primarily focused on the Sabbath and holidays. The human, primarily focused in the people of Israel, and of course, God, divine. But the ultimate vision of Judaism is the expansion of the holy from its specific space, time, human, to the whole world. In other words, life is to be sanctified and the world is to be sanctified everywhere. That's the ultimate vision. And were that to take place, we would have the ultimate vision of Judaism in this world.
Can I ask you... Can I ask you, as a non-Jewish person, is there one component of Judaism that stands out in your life that has affected your own understanding of living of life?
Probably the feeling of accountability. Meaning, the center of Judaism is to endow life with meaning. So sometimes when people get... maybe not, the word depressed may be too strong, but fear that things are not going anywhere by one's own efforts, or that one is not connected to something which transcends oneself, or the sense of, oh, it's not worth, that life is not worth anything. To some degree, a God-directed world helps overcome a tendency towards cynicism, or what I call despair, just giving up on efforts, between human relationships, long-term planning. Even, by the way, having children is really an investment in the future.
Yes.
Getting married is an investment in the future. Trying to change the world for better is an investment in the future. And I think this belief that one has a divine partner in one's efforts can keep one going when the going gets tough.
Well, thank you very much for that answer. I can certainly, as a non-Jewish person, I can certainly agree with that. Unfortunately, we're coming up to the end of the hour again. I would like to ask you if the audience want to learn more about your work or Judaism in general. Is there a website that would be a good place for them to start?
Well, I have two websites which may be helpful.
Okay.
One is called the Moral Meaning of the Bible.
Okay.
.com. They go on there, they can find things.
Sure.
And another one is called JewishPrayerBook.com. And nowadays, with the web, you can almost plug in any word you want, like the Sabbath, Yom Kippur,
yes.
Torah, and you'll get everything you want in the world.
Yes, but it's nice to have them from
experts.
But
the specific ones which I have developed, because I'm focusing upon using the Bible as a source of moral reasoning,
yes.
And understanding the Jewish prayer book as a source of both literature and history.
Yes.
So these, the moral meaning of the Bible is the first one.
Yes.
And JewishPrayerBook.com is the second.
Thank you.
There's a lot of things which can be accessed.
Thank you so
CDs
much.
And so on.
I hate to cut you off. I want to thank you very, very much for being with us today, Rabbi Kimmelman. It's been really interesting. There's so much to explore about this. Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
Michael, that would be wonderful.
And I want to thank our listeners for joining us for Godspeed today. Here on the Progressive Radio Network. If you'd like to hear this or any of the previous shows again, or send it to someone, just go to theprogressiveradionetwork.com and click on the archive link. We hope you enjoyed the show today, and we hope you will join us again as we continue to explore the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed.